Miami's toll roads, helping families with disabled children save for the future, and the Norton Art Museum starts a new residence program. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Florida lawmakers voted on a bill to end the Miami-Dade Expressway Authority, but a judge called that law a violation. What happens now to MDX, and what does that mean for drivers in Miami? Also, one of the greatest challenges for parents of children with disabilities is what happens once that child becomes an adult. There's a federal program called ABLE. It helps families save money, tax-free, to help that child live a financially secure life. We'll meet a mother who's using the program. Finally, the Norton Art Museum in West Palm Beach is about to launch a new artist-in-residence program. It puts four artists chosen from around the globe into free housing owned by the museum. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Earlier this year, the Florida legislature voted for, and Governor DeSantis signed, HB 385. It was the law that killed the Miami-Dade Expressway Authority, MDX. But the folks at the MDX fought back, took it to court, and recently, Leon County Circuit Judge John Cooper sided with MDX. He said the legislature basically violated the home rule provision. Now the Florida Department of Transportation has stepped in. They've asked an appeals court to order the dismissal of the constitutional challenge. We're joined now by Miami-Dade County Mayor Carlos Jimenez. He's also the board chairman for MDX. Mayor Jimenez, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure being here.
The original bill, it was put together by Representative Brian Avila of Miami Springs and Senator Manny Diaz Jr. of Hialeah Gardens, again, pushing to end MDX, create a new entity. When this was still being debated, though, in committee and then on the floor, I mean, you had wanted to talk to the governor about avoiding all of this and even possibly coming up with something else.
Right.
Did you ever talk to the governor, Governor DeSantis about it?
No, the governor never gave me an audience on this issue. He cited and listened, unfortunately, completely to his legislators up in the state, falsely saying that it was the delegation here wanted this. Actually, the majority of the delegation did not want this. Certain people in leadership wanted it, like the speaker and Representative Avila, who is in the leadership role up there, and also Senator Manny Diaz. In conjunction also, I have to say, probably the lieutenant governor was very much involved in this, in all of this.
You still want to meet with the governor?
Of course.
You still want to talk? Okay, so
sure.
If you got that chance, what is it that you think would be you'd be able to talk with him about?
Well, I think that this has ramifications beyond MDX. This has ramifications for projects in all the state of Florida. Remember, one of the things that I said would happen, which was the downgrading of the bonds of MDX. But also something else has happened and actually happened before is that MDX or GMX, even if that exists, cannot issue bonds because the bond rate, you cannot get a clean bond opinion from your bond council because it is quite evident if these laws stay that the rate setting authority does not lie with the board. It actually lies with Tallahassee, which means that the bond covenants are actually being violated. Therefore, you really can't issue bonds. You can't issue bonds. You can't complete the projects that you've started. Some of the projects started, you can't complete the projects that are in the work program, which is part of the law, which says these projects must be completed.
And GMX that you mentioned, that was what they wanted to create with the law, was the Greater Miami Expressway Authority. That would be the new entity. All right, so now you have this additional challenge from the Department of Transportation. Again, in the petition that was released Monday night, the DOT asked the appeals court to issue a writ of prohibition. This would essentially order dismissal of the lawsuit that Judge Joe Cooper ruled on.
Right.
If the department's successful, I mean, what does that mean for MDX? You don't think it will be, but
no, I don't think it will be successful. And then what it means for MDX is that that was just the first arrow. There's other reasons why this law is, we believe, unconstitutional and violates statute. There is tortious interference. There was a transfer agreement. The people of Miami-Dade County actually paid for those roads. They paid $91 million back in the 90s to obtain the right to solely operate, maintain these roads. And so when the transfer agreement actually says that MDX will actually operate those roads in perpetuity. That's a contract between MDX, people of Miami-Dade County, and the state of Florida.
The five roads that
absolutely
under the control of MDX.
Absolutely.
Okay. So we had Senator Manny Diaz Jr. here last week, and we talked about this recent judge's decision. And again, the judge saying this was a home rule issue, and he disagreed. Here was what he said. Mm-hmm.
This is not a home rule issue because this was a statutorily created entity by the state legislature, and the state legislature has its authority to create an entity such as a transportation authority. It was not created by home rule. It was created by state statute, and then the way it was implemented, it were given the local authority to appoint members of the board and remain local control, and the funds remain locally. But remember, these were five state roads that were turned over to these authorities. So had the legislature not passed a statute to create MDX, the county couldn't arbitrarily create it.
So he's saying the roads were given to MDX, and
no,
MDX was created.
They weren't given to MDX.
Okay.
They were, remember, MDX paid. So he has a fundamental lack of understanding of what home rule really is. The state statute allowed Miami-Dade County to create MDX because the state cannot create MDX, just like the state cannot create GMX. The Board of County Commissioners is the only entity that can create such an authority solely within Miami-Dade County. So he has a fundamental lack of understanding of what home rule really is. What home rule says, and by the way, it's part of the Constitution of the State of Florida, and it gives Miami-Dade County certain powers. What it says is that we're allowed to govern ourselves. The state can issue laws, what's called general application, that applies to all counties, and then Miami-Dade County has to comply with those laws. But the state cannot come in and say, we are going to create an expressway authority in Miami-Dade County that governs roads that only are in Miami-Dade County. That's a clear violation of the home rule. The reason that the statute was written that way is so that it actually allowed Miami-Dade County to create that authority, but the state could not create that authority on its own. Miami-Dade County had to take the step to pass an ordinance to create MDX. But what they failed to do with GMX is they created GMX by themselves, and GMX is only operating in Miami-Dade County, on Miami-Dade County, and has the roads are only in Miami-Dade County. That's where the judge says that's a clear violation of home rule. So it's a fundamental lack of understanding of what really home rule is.
And here's one other thing that he had said on this idea of he argues again that it's not taking power away from the locals. This is what he said.
If you look at the makeup of the law with the new GMX, it's actually continues to be completely local control. Despite the rumors, none of the funds leave Miami-Dade County. They stay in those roads. Simply, what was implemented was some more rigorous transparency. There was a change in the board to allow for more locals to be appointed with the input from the eight local mayors, which are the largest eight cities, which sit on the TPO. So all it did is reconfigure some of that.
And again, that's State Senator Manny Diaz Jr. He was on the program last week.
So except not true, because
okay.
MDX right now, when they want to create a new project, can create a new project. It's all autonomous inside Miami-Dade County. Now, when you want to do a new project with GMX, it actually has to go up to Tallahassee, and there's this board that is governed by the Speaker and the President of the Senate that gives the okay to do projects here in Miami-Dade County. So there is no local autonomy to GMX. They don't even have the local autonomy to, if they had to, raise rates. They'd have to go through some process of the state to allow the raise. Now, what's funny about this whole thing is that the entity that hasn't raised their rates or toll rates here since for the last 5 years has been MDX. The entities that have raised the rates the last 5 years has been State of Florida roads like the Turnpike and the I-95 and now the newly created Palmetto Express Lanes. Okay, that's a new toll. That's all State of Florida. The State of Florida is the one that raises their rates every single year. This is a massive smokescreen. This is a Tallahassee takeover of roads that are really, the system is run well. There has been no hint of lack of transparency. Everything is done completely in the sunshine, according to state law and our local ordinances. And so this is a total smokescreen by the state saying that, hey, we got to take control of these tolls, when in fact, the toll agencies that are actually tolling us to death are the state of Florida.
How much is the project, the big project, the extension of the 836? How much of that is at the center of all this?
I think a lot of it is, to be honest with you. And we, I still haven't figured out why. What is the why here? What is the problem here? That is, there's two issues. Number one is the Expressway Authority, and then I think there was also, this is about payback for some hurt feelings that some of these legislators,
from who?
From some former MDX board members that maybe didn't respect them, especially, you know, one individual that's up in Tallahassee didn't respect them. And this is basically, hey, if you don't respect us, you know, this is what we're going to do. I think you see a little bit of that with the fight with Miami-Dade College. When the former president, Eduardo Padron, said some not so very nice things about some of the members that were up there, especially some of them that are in leadership positions right now. And then all of a sudden, you know, hey, we don't want Eduardo Padron's person to be the next president of the Miami-Dade College. That's why they removed a lot of the members. Now you have to go out and search again when you had plenty of qualified people, because they want to get their own person. So what is behind this? I think what's behind this is there are people in Tallahassee that want to take wrestle control away from Miami-Dade County and the people here in Miami-Dade, and they want to put that control up in Tallahassee. Why? Well, I don't know. But it's pretty clear to me that that's what's happening, not only with MDX, but also with Miami-Dade College.
So according to the court, MDX can still continue to operate. So what is it doing right now?
No, we continue to operate until the appeal. Now, the appeal actually puts an automatic stay on the judge's ruling. And so Miami, you know, MDX is going to go and challenge and actually try to get the judge to overrule the stay so that MDX can continue to operate until this finally is heard. We believe it's probably going to go all the way to the Supreme Court. Look, the judge was pretty clear and wrote a very concise opinion as to why this was a clear violation of the home rule, a violation of the Constitution of the state of Florida. We think that we're going to prevail not only at the appellate level, but also at the Supreme Court level. And then we have the second fight, which is, okay, are they going to come at us again? I've got to get to the governor and say, look, this fight is actually costing the people of Miami-Dade County millions of dollars. It's going to cost us millions of dollars in increased financing costs because our bond rating was downgraded because of the action of the legislature. And even if right now we can't even issue bonds for some much needed projects that we need in order to alleviate traffic on our roads. Look what happened when the 836 expansion that we just did, the road work we did on the 836 expansion, that particular project increased speeds on the 836 by 20 to 25 miles an hour. That's a significant improvement. There are a lot of other improvements that we need to continue to do on the MDX system without raising tolls that will alleviate, you know, a lot of our problems here in Miami-Dade.
So it's a continued court battle. Again, talking with Miami-Dade County Mayor Carlos Jimenez, talking about the future of MDX. I want to stay on transportation just briefly on this. The other story is the future of Brightline. And there's been talks of setting up stations in Aventura, Port Miami, Boca Raton, and the county may actually pitch in to help with this. But what's the deal with the situation on Brightline?
Well, the thing with Brightline is that's one of the smart quarters, the smart plan. That's actually one of the smart quarters. The great thing about it is the infrastructure already has been built. There's $1 billion worth of infrastructure there. The rail, et cetera, has already been built. And the rolling stock's already been bought by a private company. And so we're working with Brightline to help them put a station at Aventura and start some commuter rail here on that corridor. Maybe actually put a stop there at the port. I know Boca Raton is in conversations with them about putting a stop over in Boca Raton. But that's just the beginning of commuter rail on that particular line.
What's your take on Brightline? I mean, this is a conversation that we have from time to time. I've ridden on it a few times. Yeah, it's wonderful. It's nice. But at the same time, I also notice
it's empty a lot of the time.
Well, that's a conversation about the entire, you know, mass transit system sometime, okay? And what we, you know, what the theory is the more we add, the more that more and more people will do that. Look, all we want to do is give people options, all right? We want to give you an option, a different option from getting from Aventura to downtown, and then accessing a Metro Rail or other systems. Will everybody take it? Nope. The good thing, what's attractive about it, it's a one-time investment. They will operate, maintain the system. And if we had to do it, if we were going to do that, if we were going to put a rail line up to Aventura and up the east coast, it would cost us billions of dollars to do it, and it would cost us, you know, tens of millions of dollars to operate and maintain it. And so, in a sense, you know, you're actually leveraging the private sector on this particular project, and it is a mass transit project. We also want to enter negotiations with them about adding some additional stations so that you give people a different option. And then and that's really all we want to do. It's not one size fits all. It's not one solution for everything. Trains are not the solution for everything. In this case, the train infrastructure is already there. We might as well leverage that that investment by the private sector and then give some of our folks, you know, the ability to, you know, ride a train into work.
I want to switch things up a little bit before I let you go. I want to ask you, as we enter this upcoming year, the political season, you know, it'll be your final year as mayor. But obviously, you know, there's been a lot of talking around you about your future and, you know, what you want to do.
Right.
Have you made a decision? Because the big thing is people are saying you might run for Congress.
I'm considering running making a run for Congress. I'm considering also a couple other options that are local in nature. One of them would be running for District 7, which is my old seat back on the commission. So that's still up in the air right now. I'll probably make a decision fairly quickly. I have to, because we got to gear up for a campaign. I mean, a year away, but it's really less than a year away because the primary election is in August. So it's less than a year. But, you know, those are a couple things that I'm considering right now.
Yeah, because the other thing, too, is if you're running for Congress, too, you're running, I mean, you're a Republican.
Yes.
So, you know, I mean, look, next year, everybody talks about what it's going to be, and we don't know, but the presidential election is going to be intense either way.
Right.
So, I mean, when you consider, because as what I'm wondering is, as you consider this, is any politician, as you're running, and you have to run alongside the presidential election, how do you play that? How do you play? Is it, do you want to link yourself to the president or separate yourself from the president? Do you want to?
I link myself to the policies that I will support if I run for Congress. The same way the policies I support if I run for the commission. I've been in this town. I've been elected office for about 16 years. People understand exactly where I stand. I'm pretty much middle of the road. I think that's where the country is, actually, middle of the road. And then unfortunately, we've had politicians
on both sides. Do you really think that? Because we see so much separation.
No, I understand. That's why I want to come back. I want to bring you know, I'm a middle of the road guy. I'm a fiscal conservative. I'm a social moderate. I sometimes disagree with the president. I sometimes agree with the president. It depends on the policy. All right. And so I'm running as Carlos Jimenez. I happen to be a Republican. Yes. But people in this town know what I'm about. And also, you know, that I've been a pretty good public servant here, and I've run a pretty good operation, and I've done a pretty good job being mayor of Miami-Dade County. The expansion of our economy, the you know, diversification of our economy here. So I have a pretty clear idea of what I want to accomplish, not only here in Miami-Dade, but also just not only Miami-Dade, but I think the country needs to come back into the middle. I mean, it's the two parties are way out of the mainstream, I think.
Do you think you can do more on a local level compared to what you might be able to do in D.C.?
Great question. And that's one of the things, thought processes that are going through my mind right now. Where do I think that, you know, I could do better? Obviously, Mayor of Miami-Dade County, you can do a lot. As a commissioner, you're one of 13. As a congressperson, you're, I guess, one of 400 or something. But you know, that's something that I'll have to discuss with my family. And in the end, it'll be a family decision of what I want to do. I want to continue to serve. I really want that. I'm a public servant. Started out as a firefighter 40-something years ago. That's in my blood.
And you said you have to make this decision pretty quick.
And I do. And I will.
All right. So, well, when you do, yeah, we welcome you to come on the program and let us know what that is going to be.
Absolutely.
Again, he is Miami-Dade County Mayor Carlos Jimenez, and again, talking about, we talked about MDX and other transportation issues and talking about his future. And you know what? We'll bring him back on when that comes up. So, Mayor Jimenez, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right. Still to come, we're going to learn about a program that helps families of children with disabilities to save more money, especially when that child becomes an adult. That's coming up next on the program. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Turning 18 is oftentimes a big milestone many teenagers and their parents look forward to. Their child officially becomes an adult under U.S. law. But for parents of children with disabilities, it could be a frightening time. They face losing the legal right to make important decisions for that now adult child, like medical, legal, and life decisions. And one of those life decisions is saving money for the future. In 2014, President Obama signed the ABLE, Achieving a Better Life Experience Act. It offers families with children who have disabilities to be able to save up to $15,000 tax-free every year for day-to-day expenses. Joining us now is John Finch. He's the director of ABLE United, and he joins us from the WFSU studios in Tallahassee. John Finch, thank you so much for joining us.
Luis, thank you so much for having me today. I appreciate it.
And also with him is Bridget Hawk. Her oldest son has a disability, and she's been using the ABLE Act to help him build a life for himself. Bridget Hawk, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Bridget, I want to start with you, actually. Tell me a little bit about your son, Sean, because he's in college now, but help me understand. He was diagnosed, and I don't want to mess this up, athetoid cerebral palsy?
That's correct. When he was born with the cord around his neck three times, so he was basically born not breathing. And so we always knew that there could be an issue. And, you know, early on, he didn't make those milestones and was ultimately diagnosed with athetoid CP. And it does not affect him so much mentally, but physically. He has a difficulty walking, running, things like that, and some fine motor skills, as well as speech. He has difficulty with his speech.
And he's in college now.
He is. He's a senior at UNF in Jacksonville, and we're very proud of all he's accomplished so far.
What's he studying up there?
He is studying computer science with a minor in business.
What are his goals? What does he want to do?
You know, his goals are like anyone else's goals, you know, grow up, get a good job, buy a house, have a car, have a normal life. You know, he's you know, entitled to that just like anyone else's, and that's what he wants to do.
Tell me what it was like for you, for the family, when he turned 18. You know, I think about, I have a family member who has an autistic son. I remember when that son turned 18, there was a lot of challenge.
It was a lot of challenge because, you know, however, Sean always let us help, you know, with those decisions, and he always had his own input, but now it was, my input didn't matter. He went to school. I couldn't talk to anybody about, you know, hey, this is the first time my child with a disability will be living, you know, from under my roof, and I need some guidance as to being sure that you're going to be taking care of him. They didn't want to hear anything from me. So it was, you know, everything goes through him because he's an adult, and that was a scary time for us because, you know, we wanted him to succeed, but we weren't really sure what that looked like.
And just real quickly, you know, when he goes off to, when he went off to college, you know, what sort of support did he need that he was used to having with you?
He got a lot of support first in high school. You know, he had a one-on-one aide that helped carry his books places and get things out for him because, you know, that fine motor is kind of difficult for him. And then living on his own, there were so many things that as a parent we automatically did for him because, you know, he struggled to do those things. You know, one of the things that he really wanted to do was to drive a car, and that was something we put off for a long time. But going to college, it was something that he needed. So we looked for support on campus and with some services outside of that. And, you know, we were able to get that, and he's succeeding because of those supports.
And by the way, when he was growing up, I mean, did he had the opportunity to work, right?
He had the opportunity, but there was nothing really that was out there for him that physically he was able to do. And that's really why he turned to computers. At the age of 12, he wrote and did his own app for the phone without us even knowing about it, and taught himself many different languages. And it's something that he can do because of his disability, so it makes it that much better. So he always strived to do that. He can't be a bagger at a grocery store because he can't carry and lift the stuff. So it was really tough finding part-time work for him, and we just really never knew what, if anything, was out there.
Yeah. John Finch, I mean, you hear these stories, and I'm wondering, you know, what's the theme underneath all of them? How, you know, these families struggle to find that, just that basic support, because, again, as once the kid turns 18, they're an adult under the law, and they're on their own.
Yeah, and it started with parents just like Bridget, who said, you know, looking at their child, thinking of the future, saying they're going to turn 18, they might become eligible for supplemental security income or Medicaid services, and I can't put any money aside for them because when they do turn 18, that could negatively impact them and might not allow them to get those resources and services. And so so thanks to Bridget and parents like her that sat around over a decade ago prior to 2014 of the passing of ABLE Act, where they sat around and said, you know, how can we make this a reality? And so they knew that 529 college savings plans existed. They've been around since the 90s, and their typical children could put money in there. So when they turned of age and went off to college, they could use those accounts to pay for higher education expenses. Florida Prepaid, for example, just celebrated their 30th anniversary. But there really wasn't a tool or a mechanism for parents to do that. And so, but thankful to the ABLE Act, that really just changed everything.
And that's something interesting, is it? Because, again, people with disabilities, different disabilities, they qualify for some of these other programs. But if in the past, if you had money saved up, it could affect your ability to get those federal programs, right?
Yeah. And so the ABLE Act, one of the biggest key advantages is the money in the account doesn't count towards that $2,000 resource limit that a lot of these public government benefits have. So supplemental security income, Medicaid, Florida SNAP, those type of public benefit services really restricts how much money you can have. And so the ABLE account came along and said, well, let's remove that barrier and allow families and friends and even themselves to put money aside and then not impact that resource. And then on top of that, this is a tax advantage account. So it allows people to have the potential to have tax-free growth on their account so they can use those monies at any time for a variety of expenses and then not penalize them for taking the money out and using it for those qualified disability expenses. I know Bridget's son, Sean, has a great story. He was a model case of an individual turning 18, waiting to get SSI. It's like, okay, here you go. And it was much more than $2,000 because it was a payback situation. And so instead of being in this spin down situation where you're just buying whatever instead of something you need, he was able to sock those funds away into an ABLE account and then use it later on to help purchase that vehicle.
So it's the ability to save money without threatening any other support you might be qualifying for, but also the ability to get that money out whenever needed.
Exactly. And that's how our program runs. And it's very similar to the Florida 529 savings plan. It's an online platform. So you visit ableunited.com. That's how you learn more about the program, see if you're eligible, but then actually to enroll and manage your account. And we really, before we launched, wanted to make sure that this was a program and a product that people could use. So we have 8 various different investment and savings options. So people can use this as a FDIC insured savings product. They can use it in as an investment account. We have 2 Vanguard options, a U.S. stock and a U.S. bond option. We even have an international stock option by BlackRock. So people can kind of create their own portfolio. But our most popular options are our 3 pre-designed portfolios, a conservative, moderate, and growth that has diversified already for you and gives a broad exposure to the market and really depending on your risk tolerance and savings goals on how you want to use this ABLE account for you.
And Bridget, you know, I wondered because it was interesting you were telling me about, you know, how Sean found a way, you know, to kind of make his way through because of the challenges that he faced, that he couldn't get maybe that typical job that the high school or college student gets. But what are some of the challenges, and maybe you've seen this in other families, what are the challenges of saving money?
Well, everything costs so much money, so it is hard to save, especially when, like Sean gets the supplemental income, you know, $700 and some a month doesn't really get you very far, especially if you have to have an apartment and feed yourself. That really doesn't cover even a portion of that. So, you know, it is hard for them to save anyone with a disability for, you know, I have tons of friends with children with disabilities, and they are, you know, baggers at Publix, which is great. They have a job, but at the same time, you know, it's not enough for them to do things on their own, you know, for them to save for that, you know, dream that everyone has in the future of owning your own home and owning your own car and whatever, if it's a vacation even. You can't make enough money to save enough money. So this gives us the chance that, you know, for Christmas, people ask, hey, Sean, what do you want for Christmas? Donate to my Able account. Help me save.
You send the money. It helps out a lot more. You know what? I mean, the other thing, too, is looking ahead into the future. And actually, you know what I wanted to ask you, too, is with any medical expenses that he has, is that something that through the money he saves in the Able account that he can use, or is that covered by other, you know, federal programs?
Well, for Sean right now, he's still covered under our insurance until he turns 23.
Right.
And then he also has the Medicaid supplement. But in the future, he won't be covered under us. And, you know, it's not a guarantee that he'll get the Medicaid. So, yes, he can use that, you know, towards any of that stuff. I know that dental isn't covered. And thankfully, right now, he doesn't have any issues with dentists. But if that, you know, if there was an accident or something like that, he'd be able to use that money. You know, it'll be available to him right away.
I'm talking with Bridget Hawk. She's a mother and an advocate within the disability community. Her son, Sean, has the movement disorder, athetoid cerebral palsy. But we're talking about this ABLE Act, again, an act that was put into law in 2014, which allows for these families to be able to save money on the side, tax-free, and not put at risk any of the other federal programs that they may be able to get. And this helps folks, young people, especially when they become an adult, be able to save money for everyday expenses. I'm also talking with John Finch. He's the director of ABLE United. They're joining me from the studios of WFSU in Tallahassee. Bridget, you know, you were one of the first people to sign up for the act. If other parents are listening right now, what do you say to them about where to begin?
You can just visit the ABLE website. It's really simple to get started. It's self-explanatory, walks you right through, asks, you know, a couple questions, and you're able to do, you know, pretty quickly. I want to say it didn't take us more than 10 or 15 minutes to set it all up. And, you know, now Sean has the ability to go in on his own. I don't go in for him. He goes in and he checks his account regularly, puts money in, takes money out. And it's really simple. It's really easy. I encourage everyone, you know, just do it. Just sign up. It doesn't cost you anything. It's the best way to save.
John, this also kind of goes to that idea of teaching people how to save.
Yeah, it does. I think that's a key initiative that, especially this week coming up on October 12th as National Savings Day campaign, or at National Savings Day, and we're running a competition or a contest this week offering three lucky individuals a chance to win an iPad and a $50 Able United account contribution. But the whole idea is just start somewhere. And so for our program, it's a $25 minimum contribution to get the account open and to get started. But then after that, it's really up to you and your ability to save. And the great thing is that, like Bridget was saying, for Sean, is he can have family and friends, even organizations contribute to his ABLE account, and it not count as income towards him, which would impact his benefits. And so it's just getting started. And you can set up reoccurring contributions. The system allows you to do that. And we even have a cool gifting page that people can set up, and then you can put on social media or email blast to friends that allows people to contribute online either through their bank account or a debit card. So we're just providing those opportunities and just getting the word out there really helps individuals save.
And coming back to how this works, I mean, this was a federal law, but it's basically saying to the states, provide these opportunities for your citizens, right? And so this is really going through the state of Florida.
Correct. And so what's unique is when the ABLE Act passed, it really just allowed states to create these tax advantage programs. And it was up to each individual state to see how we were going to set it up. And here in the state of Florida, they thought best to go with Florida Prepaid College Board, who has a 30-year history of helping over a million families save for higher education expenses. And so knowing that they had the tools and resources in place to launch this type of program, they housed it under there. And so
They house it under there? Does that mean they're investing into that prepaid program?
Yeah, the Florida Prepaid Program oversees it. Okay. It is a state-run organization. And so they kind of do the administrative work, but we it's not John Finch investing your money. Your money's with Vanguard and BlackRock, but we're the people behind the scenes making sure everything works correctly.
John, what are like one or two of the biggest concerns or questions that you hear from families?
I would say the number one question we often receive is, am I eligible? And so high level, the requirements is that the disability had to be diagnosed prior to age 26. So we get some questions on that, where some of these types of disabilities might occur after that, where they wouldn't meet that requirement. The other one is they have to be a Florida resident at the time they apply. And then the last one is the disability has to be severe. So if you're receiving supplemental security income or Social Security disability insurance based on work or your parents' work history, you would qualify. But if you're not, as long as you have a severe disability, so people with autism, it could be mental health disorders, respiratory issues like cystic fibrosis.
Yeah. How do you determine the severity?
Yeah. And so we have on our website, we actually have an eligibility tool that kind of walks you through that process of what that looks like and gives you examples that the IRS has provided on the types of disabilities that they cover. And so I usually tell people, if it's something that impacts your daily living and you need either additional supports or services, then you probably would meet the requirement of the severity. And I would say the next question we probably often get is, how do these compare to special needs trusts? Because those have been in existence for quite a while as well. And they often work, they're compatible to a special needs trust, and often they're funded. A lot of our ABLE accounts we're seeing are funded by third-party special needs trusts, where a special needs trust is more of an estate planning tool. A lot of times it's funded with parents' life insurance policies, so when they pass away, there's funds available or assets outside of that. And so, but they are costly set up, and it does take an attorney to do that, and usually there's a trustee involved. But they are compatible together. So we see a lot of people saying, how do these work together to truly make it a better life experience for the individual with a disability?
Bridget, let me finish with you. After getting into the program, I mean, how did it change your life and Sean's life?
Well, it definitely changed Sean's for sure. He was, he got this big lump sum of money. And, it was like John had said earlier, most people have to go ahead and just spend that because you're not allowed to have more than $2,000. So Sean took that money and put it in his ABLE account and started looking for a car. So he was able to put a down payment on a car and has never looked back. And he's, more than ecstatic about that. And he's also saved a lot of money to go towards his education. Unfortunately, I'm not an extremely wealthy person, and he needs to contribute towards that. So he's ready to go. As soon as he graduates, that money will be there to pay off those loans. So I think in that aspect, he's coming ahead of the game. When he graduates, he'll have money aside to do those things and be able to continue to save at the same time.
And when's his graduation?
Graduates in May of this year, so we're very excited for him.
Well, congratulations there, and best wishes for the future for him, and I hope he's enjoying that ride. I remember my first car. Not the best car, but it was my first. It didn't matter. It was it was a car. I was happy.
Yeah. Well, Bridget, thank you so much.
Bridget, thank you so much for sharing, and John, thank you again. And by the way, John, real quickly, where can people go if they want information?
Yes, ableunited.com.
And we will share that, by the way, on our website and on our social media, WLRN Sundial. John Finch, director of ABLE United Florida. We also heard from Bridget Hawk, mother and advocate, both joining us from WFSU in Tallahassee. John, Bridget, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, still to come, the Norton Museum of Art is going beyond just finding great art. They're now bringing in major artists for museum lovers to meet. That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. The Norton Museum of Art recently announced the inaugural class of its Artist in Residence program. Four artists from across the globe will be staying in West Palm Beach for 6 weeks beginning next year. They'll be living in the 1920s-era housing that's adjacent to the museum. Now, the housing properties are owned by the Norton and are historic buildings. They've been refurbished into bungalows. Tim Wright is the photo curator for the Norton Museum, and he was part of the selection process of picking the artist, and he joins us now. Tim, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Lewis. I really appreciate your interest.
Why did the Norton Museum want to launch a residence program and bring artists in?
Well, you know, our history is really tied into living artists. When Mr. Norton was buying his collection, which is really the core of the Norton's collection, he was buying from living artists, and we take that pretty seriously. And for those of us that deal with contemporary art, it's something we get to do all the time. And so we thought, well, what a great opportunity to bring artists and our experience of dealing with them to our audiences.
I got to say, I was there with the Sundial team. We were there for the grand reopening, I guess, when after all of the, you know, when the Norton went through, it's basically a big facelift is what it did. We came by and we passed by those houses as they were being refurbished. And we were thinking, wow, those are beautiful. But these are historic places.
They are. You know, we've had those as part of the Norton campus for quite some time. And I have to tell you, now that they're redone, there's a lot of us that would really like to be an artist in residence.
Yeah, they looked really, really nice. So you picked four artists, and they're going to spend 6 weeks at a time living, you know, in these houses. What's the process, though? What was the process for picking these? And you got them from all over the world.
Well, they're from all over the world, but they're really based in the United States. We really did try to kind of limit ourselves because you could really take this way out. But what we did is the curators and kind of our leadership team decided that probably the best thing to do is take it outside of what we know. And so we contacted people that we know around the country who deal with contemporary art, who work with living artists, and just asked them, who do you think would really benefit from 6 weeks just thinking about their work? Because that's really all we require. You don't have to make anything if you don't want to. But for an artist, the gift of time is probably the most precious thing you could get. So we have all these curators across the country. We asked four of them to submit a list of six or seven artists that they thought would benefit. And we just winnowed it down from there.
And how long did that process take?
We were amazingly fast in this. Having been on selection committees before, they can last forever. But we did it probably within about 12 weeks.
12 weeks to winnow it down to these four.
It was pretty, yeah, it was pretty fun. I mean, once you lock yourself in a room, the process goes very fast.
Force it to happen.
I'm
talking with Tim Ride, photo curator for the Norton Museum of Art. Again, they announced their inaugural artist in residence program. Four artists have been selected to live in the housing adjacent to the Norton Museum, and they're going to live there for 6 weeks at a time, and this begins in January. Interesting, Tim, you just said that there's really no expectation on them. They don't have to create any art. They're going to be there for 6 weeks. What's the thinking behind that?
Well, you know, some artists are in a point in their creative process. You know, everybody's got a different process. So sometimes an artist will come in and they're really about research, or they'll just be about that moment where they can sit down, not have to worry about, is there gas in the car? Where am I going? Where do I need to be? Are the kids in school? They just need time to sit and think about what's important to them at the moment. And then other artists will come in and they'll bring everything they need to make work, and you'll see somebody come out with a body of work. You just never know. I always like to say that, you know, contemporary art's a messy business, but it's also unpredictable. And it's sometimes even unpredictable for the artists. And so we're very conscious of providing that space to allow them to do what they need to do. The only thing we really require of them is that that they interact with their audiences, that they kind of take a look at our collections and react to them and then interact with audiences based on that.
Let's get to know a little bit about them, because even though they're based out of the U.S., you've got one from who's originally from Ghana, one from Nashville, one from the Bahamas, and one from Seoul, South Korea. Tell me a little bit about each one.
Exactly. Our first two artists are two women, as it happens. Adélie Dzaghe is pretty amazing. She's Ghanaian-American, and she's living in Portland, Oregon. She got her MFA out of the Washington University in St. Louis. So she's bounced around, but she's an interesting artist. You know, if you go to contemporary art fairs, there's a kind of trend right now. You're seeing a lot more fabric artists, and she deals with fabric, with fiber, and yet she makes sculpture out of it. And then she prints new fibers and new fabrics that actually relate to the place she's in. And so it's all about kind of absorbing her place and then creating something that relates to the place out of fabric. So she's, you know, is she a sculptor? Yeah. Is she a printmaker? Yeah. Is she a painter? Also. You know, that's the beauty of this. And it's really what's happening in contemporary art right now. It's like you really can never pin one person down to just one media.
And that's the first two are women, right?
Exactly.
And then the other two.
And the other two, Jessica Ingram is actually a local yokel. She lives and works in Tallahassee and teaches at FSU. And she's the only photographer of the group, though all of them kind of use video. And she's pretty interesting. But it's LeVar Monroe who I think just situationally is poised to really do something interesting here. You know, he was born in the Bahamas. And with what really has just happened to the Bahamas, he's going to be very close and yet very far away from home. You know, he got his MFA also from Washington University, which is, we didn't plan it that way. It just happened that way.
Yeah.
But he's fascinating. Again, he's a sculptor. He's a painter. He includes installation work. I really think that the breadth of the types of work and types of artists that we got was exactly what we needed this first go around.
And do you envision, you know, this program expanding beyond these four artists? You want to continue doing that? Or what are you going to do with those houses?
Well, this is just the first year. And so we see this going on and on into the future. You know, I think that once our audiences and our supporters see the potential of this thing, they're really going to buy into it. And then expect it. You know, we're looking at this point because we only have two residencies this first year, and the buildings will be, quote, empty during the summer. We also do a summer internship program that we draw from all over the country, amazing graduate students and some postgrads. So it's pretty good.
And as you said, you know, the only thing really that you expect of the artist is that at some point they do have to talk and meet with people. You know, they don't have to produce work, but they kind of have to, you know, meet with
somehow
people.
There needs to be a program that these artists can do. Sometimes, you know, sometimes you meet contemporary artists who just shouldn't talk. And so sometimes.
But I will tell you. You said it, I didn't. That's okay.
Well, you know, I've met too many artists. And so sometimes it'll be about teaching a workshop. Or sometimes we're really going to play their strengths and allow them to kind of set the discourse.
I know I've met enough artists myself that, you know, some of them are open to letting people watch their process. And not all of them do that, though. Do you think that'll happen?
I always hope it could happen. You know, as a curator, I try not to do that because it just makes me crazy. But for people that aren't used to being around artists that are making really important work, I think it's fascinating.
Yeah. No, if they get the chance, it really is. So this starts again in January, right?
Right. So the first session, which will be two artists, starts on the 13th of January, and they'll be there to the middle of February. And then the second session will start in March, the beginning of March, and run through the middle of April.
Again, this is a fascinating new program at the Norton Museum of Art, you know, opening up. They have those houses right there adjacent to the museum, historic houses, by the way, for this new artist-in-residence program, and they're bringing in four artists starting early next year. And maybe we'll get the chance to meet them as well. So, Tim Wright, again, photo curator for the Norton Museum of Art. Tim, a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Lewis, you have an open invitation anytime you want to come up.
Absolutely. All right. Again, learn more about Norton's new AIR program. We'll have it up on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Well, that's our program for this Tuesday, October 8th, coming up tomorrow on the show. As traditional malls across the U.S. are seeing fewer and fewer customers, there's an interesting proposal in Palm Beach County. The Boynton Beach City Council is considering transforming the mall into an auditorium. What do you think? Could malls work well as public event spaces, like for political speakers or concerts? We're going to hear from a Palm Beach Post columnist about that. Plus, we're going to learn about the history of Carnival, an incredible festival and a tradition in the Caribbean for hundreds of years. There's a massive carnival happening this week in Miami-Dade County. Our reporter, Nadesh Green, will tell that story. And get your taste buds ready, because the Bailey Contemporary Arts in Pompano Beach has launched a Caribbean Culinary Museum. We taste the spice and the food of the Caribbean and understand the commonalities across those cultures. So, yeah, we're going to have some fun tomorrow. All of that on the program. Find us at WLRN.org. Again, find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. I'm Lewis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you tomorrow.